WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a research-based master's degree in biological sciences covering diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology. With a 90% placement rate, become a leader in a science field that is shaping the future. Details at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am always pleased and honored to be able to speak with a faculty colleague from Carthage, Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and responsible for columns that appear in newspapers across the country and outside our borders as well, and someone who is also a frequent and regular guest on WUWM up in Milwaukee. And I'm glad that the morning show is a monthly part of his busy life and that we can have the opportunity to speak on a number of different issues and concerns. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's always a pleasure, and you're always most gracious.
And you're having a good spring semester thus far over there in the Clausen Center?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I've been teaching in person and this academic year, including in the fall. And for me, it's gone quite well. And it's always a tonic to be around young people, young men, and that includes you, of course. But the students, I think, are handling this overall quite well and set a good example for the rest of us in terms of basic natural optimism. So that's my message for the day.
Very good. Before we explore some of your most recent columns and some interesting topics you explored, I thought maybe it would be good for us to begin with your sort of basic impressions of this new administration of our new president, Joe Biden. What have been your impressions thus far of the way in which he is getting off the ground?
I think it's been quite orderly. He's keeping a low profile, and I think that's he's keeping a calm profile. President of the United States, by definition, is not a low profile individual, we hope anyway. And I tend to be very positive about him. We all have our own biases, but I think he brings undeniably experience, whether or not you agree with the basically liberal political approach of the Democrats. He brings a lot of experience, and I believe at some level, quite apart from my own biases, I hope, I think at some level that's reassuring for people beyond his partisans. So I am positive. He's survived a long time in Washington, a rough environment for anyone, as we all know, and I think that that in itself should be reassuring.
I remember one of your most frequent criticisms of President Barack Obama, under whom, of course, Joe Biden served as vice president, was that you saw in President Obama, if I remember correctly, a certain kind of aloofness that that he did not seem particularly interested in or willing to, in a sense, kind of get in the trenches and generate agreements with leaders on Capitol Hill on maybe divisive issues where there was a lot of disagreement. I mean, compared to some presidents who seem to kind of revel in that admittedly steep challenge. So, I mean, I hope I'm characterizing that criticism. I mean, you had positive things to say about him, but I remember that being a criticism. And I wonder if what you were just now saying about Joe Biden is potentially different. That is, as someone who spent so much time on Capitol Hill, that he has the potential perhaps to connect with Congress and work out things with Congress, maybe in a way that some other recent presidents have not.
Yes, I think that's true. He has a reputation as a deal maker and someone who's able to get things done, not highly partisan in the Senate, which by definition is a more collegial, the more collegial as well as more senior house of Congress by constitutional design. I don't think it's my criticism of President Obama. That was a fairly common reference about him, including from people in his own party who worked with him. I voted for President Obama. I'm glad I did. I think there are extremely important positive reasons why it was very good for all of us Americans to have that particular individual in the White House. But I think in a very real sense, Joe Biden seemed to be the one that was carrying a lot of the water in terms of dealing with the bureaucracy as well as with the Congress. Mind you, my own opinion, and this goes beyond widespread reliable media reports, I think that's been a fairly long-term trend since the turn of the century. I do believe that Mike Pence was the day-to-day president in the Trump administration. And I think with hindsight, that will become increasingly clear. And Dick Cheney was very much the day-to-day chief executive during the George W. Bush administration. We have been electing celebrity presidents for a while now, and there are some advantages to that. But I think that's the way our very interesting system is evolving. So it's not unique to the current administration. It is not unique to the Obama administration. And I think it will change with the current administration.
Interesting.
It seems much more like Clinton, a natural deal maker and a president until he got in impeachment trouble, a president who had a phenomenal legislative record with Congress, equaled only by Lyndon Johnson in terms of the sheer amount of legislation that he got through. And like LBJ, he clearly thrived on that kind of political environment, and that's a major test of any politician.
Of course, we're in a political environment that is even more divisive than that faced by LBJ or President Clinton. So in some respects, probably the getting things done on Capitol Hill or working with Congress is probably a steeper challenge than it once was.
This may be reassuring for you. I don't agree with you, young man. One of my favorite Tom Clawson statements, and thank you for mentioning his name, our graduate who went on to run Bank of America and the World Bank and the namesake of our Clawson Center. He liked to express himself in very brief, blunt statements. I'm sure as his seniority increased, that tendency increased over the years. He liked to say the good old days have not yet arrived. And he was certainly correct about that. We did not have the intense party division, stark and continuous, that we have today for various reasons. It would take a little while to explain. But the 60s, Lyndon Johnson's time in office was a far worse time than today, Greg. We had the beginnings of high inflation and high unemployment combined, which remarkably we don't have today. We had very high violent crime rates, pervasive violence in the country, public demonstrations that seemed to grow worse and more dangerous as the decade wore on. During Lyndon Johnson's last year in the White House, he could only speak at military bases. Secret Service was absolutely emphatic on the subject. Any place else would be dangerous. It's the one time in my life that I thought our country was coming apart, even discounting for the fact that I was quite young and therefore relatively sensitive. No, it was a much worse time than today. And it's really important to emphasize that because the media tends to see the moment as the worst ever. And with the increasing volume of pervasive 24/7 news and non-news and fake news and infotainment and entertainment masquerading as news, it's really important for people to emphasize this.
I don't disagree with what you just said. I just want to clarify what I was saying, which is I wasn't saying we as a country are in worse shape or what the challenges President Biden faces are steeper than what Johnson faced. I was really trying to speak very specifically. I don't think I said it very clearly. I was really speaking very specifically about Congress, the state of how Congress functions right now, and how there seems to be maybe a different kind of divisiveness on Capitol Hill than there once was. I mean, not to say that everybody got along in the 60s or the 90s or whenever, but your point is very, very well taken. And I think you're absolutely right that the media in general tends not to speak to that truth very well, if at all.
We also had terrible, well, thank you. And we also had terrible political violence. I'm quite mindful, as are we all, of the violent riot in as well as around the Capitol on January 6th, but we had terrible political assassinations. President Kennedy, Dr. King, Senator Kennedy, other prominent people, Malcolm X, George Wallace in the early 70s, were killed, were wounded. It was just a terrible time.
Let's talk about something else, although, of course, it is now President Joe Biden. Former President Donald Trump continues to be in the news, albeit keeping, in some respects, an even lower profile than President Biden. But of course, there was very big news out of the U.S. Supreme Court, which would seem to indicate that those that want to investigate former President Trump's financial records and tax returns and so on are not going to be barred from doing so, and that this perhaps places him in a more vulnerable position in terms of having some of these matters explored more fully than perhaps had been the case before. That's my understanding of it, but that's a pretty limited understanding. But what would be your best guess, your educated guess, in terms of what potentially is ahead for President Trump? What are some of the ways in which he is vulnerable to investigation that could make life very complicated for him in the next months and years?
I'm a professor, of course, Professor Berg, which means I'm really good at predicting the past, and, not the future in any level of life. I certainly have learned that by now. But to give you a straight answer, I don't know. New York prosecutors have been very aggressive. I'm sure Governor Cuomo has his own political ambitions and is a Democrat. Is part of this. Federal prosecutors tend to be very aggressive in that part of the country. That's my understanding. My guess is there will be a more assertive Justice Department in the Biden administration and looking into former President Trump's affairs. I don't know what I could say that would be constructive, but one thought is this, is Donald Trump is a great survivor. After he got elected, which was a big surprise to me, I didn't think he could get nominated or elected in this country. So listeners should keep that in mind. Ovid Damaris, D-E-M-A-R-I-S, there are a lot of not very serious and superficial crime writers who get books out that make money and don't have indexes and aren't necessarily very reliable. He's a very serious journalist and researcher. He's done very good books on Jimmy Hoffa, the great Titanic conflict between Attorney General Robert Kennedy and Hoffa, organized crime. He did a book called Boardwalk Jungle, not to be confused with Boardwalk Empire, the Netflix series about gambling in New Jersey in the 70s. Everybody's solution is increasingly right, legalizing vice so we can generate income, including in the city of Chicago, I'm sorry to say. The book deals with that wild time and the tremendous violent crime that resulted from Atlantic City becoming a legal gambling center. All kinds of younger, less effective mafia types from New York, including John Gotti, before he went to prison, and others became very active in that area. It became very unstable. A man named Angelo Bruno had run organized crime in Atlantic City in New Jersey. He was head of the Philadelphia Mafia for literally decades. It had been relatively stable. He had stayed out of trouble. Showing how things were changing, one night after his longtime chauffeur and bodyguard drove him home from dinner to the modest apartment where he lived with his wife, the bodyguard suddenly disappeared. A man with a sawed-off shotgun appeared and blew Mr. Bruno's head off. That opened the door to the really Wild West activity of that period. I went back to that book because there was a young Donald Trump was active in that area. And there's a fairly sizable section of this very serious book devoted to Trump, who was in the media, shooting off his mouth, talking nonstop. The Donald Trump that we all know and some people are quite fond of today, there he was. Now, one of the first really substantial modern federal sting operations, we've mentioned the Justice Department, was focused on that area. About a half a dozen members of Congress, as a result of Abscam, about half a dozen members of Congress went to federal prison. U.S. Senator Harrison Williams was convicted and did time. Donald Trump was never caught on wire. He was never caught on film. He was never quoted. There was nothing against him. This nutty guy went through that environment without ever actually compromising himself. He has a sort of shark-like survival instinct that's not to be underestimated. And that's my thought on the subject. Don't underestimate his survival skills, especially given the way he also lived through it. He wasn't murdered. Carl Icahn, a very close friend of his father, who has repeatedly bailed Trump out of his financial difficulties, because in point of fact, outside of TV, he's not a moneymaker. He's quite the reverse. Carl Icahn protected him financially, but Trump did not compromise himself. So keep that in mind as the extremely aggressive New York State and I believe federal investigation now of Trump becomes more and more aggressive now that he's out of the White House. Extremely important subject. He's a fascinating phenomenon.
Yeah.
I don't admire him. I don't like him. I don't think he was a good president. He did reflect a very important stream of public sentiment in our great country. But don't underestimate him.
For those of you just joining us, today is the monthly visit of Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clawson Center at Carthage College. Clawson, distinguished professor of political economy and world business at Carthage, and a monthly visitor to the morning show. Professor Sear, before we get into a couple of your recent columns, one of the questions that is on the table at the moment for discussion is whether or not we should be raising the minimum wage. And it's not so much that I want you to tell us whether or not we should raise the minimum wage, but it would be really good to in a sense, have some advice from you on how we should think about an issue like that, on whether or not we should raise the minimum wage, and if so, by how much. I mean, what kind of calculations, not just mathematical, economical, should go into consideration of a very important topic like that?
Well, it's basically a political decision. There's a huge amount of economic data and analysis thereof by professional economists, which I am not, indicating that whenever you raise the minimum wage by a substantial amount, And it's more a state and even local issue than a federal issue, please keep in mind. And I think it should be. But when things go up dramatically, usually at the state level, unemployment goes up as well. And conservatives and traditionalists and a lot of business people will mention this. It's essentially a political decision. One good thing about our economy is we do have a hardcore permanent underclass economically, people generation from generation who simply live in serious poverty. That's a big problem for our very wealthy country. We should be doing better than we are. And it's not just contrary to stereotypes. It's not an African-American phenomenon by any means, and it's not an urban phenomenon. There are very large numbers of people who are part of the majority race who live in rural areas and non-urban areas who are in serious difficulty. That's a special problem. But most people, the vast majority of people in minimum wage jobs and below, go in and out of them. That population tends to be relatively young overall. And even though the minimum wage may not, and partly because it doesn't lead to there's a lot of rotation. I think it's essentially a political issue. And if politicians decide we should raise the minimum wage, I think that's fine. But I think it's not a practical economic issue. It is a challenge for business people, especially small business people. But it's essentially a political issue and part of the political debate. And that's how you and I as citizens should view it. A lot of righteous rhetoric circulates around the minimum wage. The reality is short term, it hurts low wage working people because they're more likely to be unemployed. That's the reality. But that reality has little to do with what is essentially a political debate. Vast mass of voters and people who do vote are not minimum wage workers. I hope that's clear. It's certainly different from dominant media rhetoric on the subject.
Right. Let's talk about something quite positive. And I was really heartened to see you giving attention to this in your column, namely this recent successful landing on Mars and the amazing pictures that came back from the surface of the fourth planet. And I really appreciated, among other things, how your column talking about that also kind of took the reader through the history of our efforts to reach Mars, and not just Americans, but the former Soviet Union, who actually got there before we did. Tell us why you wanted to give the kind of extensive attention that you did to this, and particularly why you thought it was important to kind of spell out this history of human beings on Mars. Why is that valuable for us to remember and or celebrate?
Well, to give you a short answer for a change, it leads to great, very helpful technological innovation. And it also leads to human collaboration. As you implied, initially it was very much part of the intents. And at the time the space race began in the late 50s, in 57, the Soviets put the first satellite up. It was driven by conflict and to a significant degree fear. And we've gone beyond that now. It's very much international cooperation.
What did you think of those images from Mars when you saw them on just kind of a personal level?
Oh, it was fantastic. I find it endlessly fascinating, and it shows how powerful technological innovation is. I'm old enough to have been around during the 69 moon landing, when the Apollo 11 crew landed successfully on the moon, fulfilling President Kennedy's great commitment to get us there and back safely. Kennedy was always careful to add to the Earth. It was quite an emotional moment in July of 69. Those grainy photographs and later film footage that was taken are a dramatic contrast with the real-time images still in video that we can see right away concerning Mars and the moon and space probes. And I believe I put a website link in my column trying to be contemporary so anybody can copy it or click on it and see what's going on. Just fantastic.
Right. I liked your line at the end of the column when you said space exploration nurtures and educates. It's a nice turn of phrase.
Yes. And it shows the human insight and human importance that adventures that are not clearly defined in terms of practical benefits for us. One important thing about the political and government dimensions of our lives, that kind of community, is it's not business and it's not day-to-day administration, public or private. Politics provides the opportunity to really go beyond the status quo in ways that are not tangible as they have to be in the business world. I know I'm not articulating this very clearly, but it shows how, especially in modern times, government politics have great potential for positive benefit. And Kennedy deserves a lot of credit for really basically initiating the manned spaceflight program and for great evil. Hitler and the Third Reich remain, I think, the most horrific and horrible example of how government can be used for utterly evil purposes and essentially insane purposes. Kennedy was really path-breaking. Eisenhower was very much opposed to manned space flight, interestingly enough. It was extraordinarily expensive. It was extraordinarily dangerous. Instruments sent back more reliable information. Ike was right about all those things. But the human dimension and the sense of adventure and renewal and practical benefit we can get ultimately from this kind of public activity. Kennedy and associates had the foresight to see that. Eisenhower, to his credit, did promote space exploration, and he was crucial in keeping it peaceful, essentially, until Reagan came along with the Strategic Defense Initiative, and then President Trump, most unhappily from my point of view, with his kind of TV program, Space Force Vision, which the U.S. Air Force, of course, immediately seized on. Eisenhower deserves a lot of credit for restraining the military, not only on the ground and on Earth, but in space as well.
Another positive story to which you draw our attention in a recent column is actually in the nation of Colombia. And I found myself learning quite a lot about the ways in which that South American country has been racked with all kinds of violence and for far longer than I had ever realized. And not that the days of violence and corruption there have ended, by no means, but there was a recent announcement there that you take to be a positive sign or an encouraging sign that even in the midst of a country as torn apart as Colombia, that progress can be made. First of all, give our listeners some context in terms of this long legacy of violence and corruption that has been so pervasive in Colombia for such a long time.
I'm not an expert on Latin America, but I am well informed enough to know that violence of a political nature has been historically part of Colombia. They had a two-party system historically, but there was, in fact, armed violence and killing, speaking of mafia activities in Atlantic City, murder was part of political competition in that particular Latin American country. Starting from 1964, way back during the earliest phases of our Vietnam War, there was an insurgency in Colombia, separate from the established system. The FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarias de Colombia, I'm sorry for fracturing the Spanish, but FARC is FARC, a short acronym for the Spanish title of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. They began to adopt a communist ideology. They're basically a drug at other and related criminal cartel of a very substantial size. But it was a time when Castro was spearheading what many people rightly feared was a dangerous communist revolutionary movement throughout Latin America. And that was true and remained true through the 1980s, in my opinion. They became very political, partly for practical reasons, but partly because people were drawn that way in the 60s. And I can assure you that the Cuban government, as in Venezuela more recently, was doing everything they could to support this activity. From my point of view, from late in the last century, it seemed to be more and more like Vietnam. After percolating along for many years, during the George W. Bush administration especially, we were sending more and more military advisors, more and more civilian advisors, often intelligence agents, police advisors, more and more weapons, especially small weapons, helicopter gunships. And G.W. Bush and associates, much like the Kennedy and Johnson people in the 60s, were trying to keep this out of the news. I became quite pessimistic about it, but it faded. Suddenly it faded, and there was a peace agreement, and Colombia evolved the way Vietnam policymakers back in the 60s were hoping that Vietnam would unfold. It's quite fascinating in a way. Most recently, there has been a National Peace Commission, Human Rights Commission, a distinctive legal body on a national basis. This is not a UN initiative primarily, that has in fact indicted and is in the process, I'm confident, of convicting senior FARC leaders. The organization not only sold drugs, but they engaged in terrorist activities. They would kidnap people for ransom. And it's that practice of kidnapping and keeping poor people, meaning unfortunate victims, for years sometimes in horrible conditions. That's the basis of these criminal charges. Several years ago, the government and the FARC signed a peace treaty. Pens, writing implements made out of gun casings. It's fascinating stuff. It was seen as significant enough that these special pens were used to sign the treaty, but it's all very heartening. We'll see what happens, but I think Americans especially should be quite heartened by the fact that this is the most dramatic evidence, among other, in Latin America, that things are moving our way compared to the Cold War era. And it's not like Vietnam, it's still out of the news pretty much until Vietnam suddenly became wildly uncontrollable from Washington's point of view. Colombia, like a lot of important developments, is out of the news these days. Major media seems to ignore it. Hmm.
Well, I appreciated all the information that you shared in that column. And of course, an even larger concern for all of us, that of nuclear Armageddon. It doesn't get much bigger than that, more significant than that. You wrote a recent column which kind of outlines at least some of the ways in which our new president is making arms control negotiations with Russia once again a very high priority. And you actually took the time in this column to kind of sketch the history of some of the most significant nuclear summits that have occurred over the last several decades. I mean, I think we all understand why we all want to avoid nuclear Armageddon, but I think you are wanting us to, in a sense, understand the kind of things that can and have been accomplished in some of these nuclear summits. Explain some of that.
Well, you're quite right. Summit meetings have been continuing since the earliest, since before the Cold War began. Modern summits really began in World War II, and I believe Winston Churchill coined the phrase after the war when he was Prime Minister of Britain for the second time. Edmund Hillary was climbing Mount Everest at about the same time, so Winston decided he would coin the term. Nuclear summits have a more specific meeting. You were talking about President Obama earlier. He really initiated these as soon as he got into office, major international meetings that, to the great credit of Obama and his associates, they were held on a very regular basis. He had the vision, as did Ronald Reagan, and I'm confident he still has it, that it would be great if we could abolish all nuclear weapons. That may or may not be really practical or wise, but this momentum dating from the earliest meetings of Allied leaders before the atomic bomb was developed and continued, especially during the Eisenhower and then Nixon and Ford administrations. It really has been important to controlling nuclear weapons. And nuclear summits, I think, were useful, even though no tangible agreement was reached. Unfortunately, Russia in 2016 declined to participate because relations were deteriorating generally with the U.S. and the West, especially after their annexation of Crimea and invasion of Ukraine. But it is an extremely important process. The most important initial one, I think, was the demilitarization of Antarctica, which Eisenhower achieved not as a result of a specific summit, although he did have summits with Soviet counterparts and our British allies and sometimes others, but as a result of the International Geophysical Year, global scientific cooperation of a comprehensive sort, which Eisenhower really spearheaded, that contributed directly to that first military agreement, demilitarization, including nuclear weapons of Antarctica, which everybody kind of ignores. The most dramatic early agreement was the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963, which President Kennedy and Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev reached not long after the terrifying Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. The Nixon administration, Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, achieved the SALT I treaties, limiting both offensive intercontinental ballistic missile launchers on land and defensive anti-ballistic missile systems. President Reagan was a strong critic of arms control, but showing how durable this process is, I believe the term START, Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, was an initiative of the Reagan administration that achieved some success. And President Biden is trying to restart this process. Obama, again, gave tremendous emphasis to this START process, which is long-term and transcends particular governments. One of the good things about nuclear weapons, because of their terrifying nature, is they've really encouraged by their very existence this arms control process, which dates, nuclear arms control dates from Eisenhower and has really been continuous, including a very hardline Ronald Reagan, who got to the White House partly by beating the drum about the Soviet threat. And then in his second term, really pursued significant arms agreements. It's kind of long-winded as usual with me, but the history is really important because it's not just a flash in the pan. It's not just the latest political thing that's come up in Washington.
I hope it's clear.
It's very complicated, and it's another subject on which I'm by no means a detailed expert.
Finally, I want to give you a chance to expand on some really intriguing things that you had to say in a recent column about the nature of intelligence. That is, intelligence and counterintelligence and the work of organizations and agencies like, for instance, the CIA. And you really delved into some intriguing things here and brought up, you know, a number of different names and so on. And so, you know, we have a column in which we're hearing about someone like Alan Dulles and someone like Sean Connery within the space of a paragraph or two. Explain the, in a sense, maybe more nuanced understanding of the nature of intelligence this kind of intelligence work that you want to us to better understand and appreciate?
Sean Connery was the first very successful, as our listeners know without me saying so, very successful Hollywood actor from Scotland. He was the first James Bond, a very durable franchise. Something else we can thank President Kennedy for, his fondness for Ian Fleming's James Bond novels sparked the launch of the film series, which has been incredibly profitable. Otherwise, it wouldn't be so durable in that business, especially. Ian Fleming, a British intelligence agent who worked closely with Alan Dulles during World War II, was also the successful novelist. We also lost John le Carré last year, both Sean Connery and John le Carré, a really favorite author of mine, and a man who was in British intelligence for a brief period of time during the Cold War. His novels have really also been very successful as books and films, and shows the importance, and they personify not only the importance of intelligence, public fascination, quite appropriately with this important subject, and also our British friends have been remarkably successful, not only at creating fictional characters who make money for Hollywood and for authors and others, but also give insight into what I think is an unusual skill of our British friends in the intelligence field. Anyway, it's a milestone. Two significant people passed away in the past year. So early in the new year is a good time to not only recognize people like that, but also to use it as an entry point for a discussion of an important subject.
Absolutely. It reminded me that from time to time, you have touched on the fact that intelligence has to be about more than just the latest technological breakthrough, and that we cannot leave it to fancy devices and fancy technologies to do some of the work that is most fundamental to intelligence work being truly successful and meaningful.
Yes. For one thing, it's very important for Americans in a very immediate sense, because it was an initial source of collaboration with our good British friends. American opinion was divided in World War I until the Germans started unrestricted submarine warfare, including sinking our ships. As the war ground on, there was a lot of pro-German sentiment, especially in the Midwest, not surprisingly, during that war. The British pursued intelligence cooperation and revealed to the Americans intelligence information that was damning for the German regime, that was very important in changing U.S. public opinion. And early in World War II, Ian Fleming actually was a British intelligence agent based in the U.S., I think from before the start of World War II, and played an instrumental role. He was not only a successful novelist and inspiration for very important big money film franchise, he actually was a British agent in New York and Washington. He was extremely important in recruiting Alan Dulles, who did an extraordinarily successful job in Switzerland, formerly neutral, a nest of spies and agents and lunatics and operators, geniuses throughout the war. Dulles really made his name there, and Eisenhower picked him as head of the CIA. And he continued into early in the Kennedy administration. The history is extremely important, but also the human side. Our British friends also, to answer your question, really emphasize the human dimension of intelligence more than we do. We have a natural fascination with technology in the good old USA. Not surprising, and it's certainly paid off for this great country since the beginning and continues. But I believe that we tend to overdo reliance on technology. Bill Clinton, the great deal maker, I think deserves part of the blame. After the Cold War, military and intelligence budgets were cut. Clinton was really anxious to diminish the human side of intelligence because he saw political advantage in emphasizing technology. And I think it changed somewhat after 9/11, but not much. We really need to keep paying attention to the British because they're much better at emphasizing the human side of things, which is key to intelligence.
Very good. Well, on that note, I appreciate the time that you've given me today to explore some interesting and intriguing and important topics, as always. Dr. Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and responsible for a column that I'm sure many of you read on a regular basis, as I do. It's always great to have you on the morning show, and I'm glad we could have this conversation and look forward to talking with you soon. And maybe one of these days, COVID permitting, maybe even having a conversation truly face-to-face instead of screen-to-screen.
Oh, I'm sure we will, and sooner rather than later. Mr. Clausen was extremely interested in using the media indirectly to help promote our fine college and other things, and he strongly encouraged this activity, especially a weekly news column, and it's a way of honoring his memory that I continue to do this. It's also enjoyable, but it is extremely important in terms of my continuing responsibilities, however things unfold at our fine college.
Very good.
So thank you very much.
Good to have you with us. Thank you again for being part of today's morning show. Tomorrow on the podcast version of The Morning Show, a step back all the way to 1999 and a look behind the scenes of one of the most highly regarded choral organizations in the country at the time, the American Boy Choir, through the eyes of a former member, Greg Lyne, who at the time of our interview was working for the Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in America. Our interview was recorded just before the American Boy Choir performed on the campus of Carthage College. It's a really fun and interesting interview, and I'm playing it on tomorrow's podcast. And on Sunday, a familiar name and voice to public radio listeners, P.J. O'Rourke, and a conversation that we recorded a number of years ago about his book in which he reflects on The Wealth of Nations, a classic book by Adam Smith. To subscribe to The Morning Show, you should go to any of your podcast providers, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Next week in the broadcasts of The Morning Show, on Monday, a really interesting conversation about an interesting book called Sex, Lies, and Handwriting. A top expert reveals the secrets hidden in your handwriting. On Tuesday, a beautifully written memoir called I'm Still Here by Martina Reeves. On Wednesday, Dr. Richard Gunderman and an all-too-timely book called Contagion. And next Thursday, a look at the women of the Bush administration through best-selling author J. Randy Tarabelli and his new book called Grace and Steel. A week from today, Larry Olmsted and his wonderfully entertaining and insightful book called Fans, How Watching Sports Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Understanding. The Morning Show is archived on our website.